You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Kim Jong-un's national haircut. What's wrong with James Arthur? Huh? Me, Rona Martin, on Gwyneth and Chris. Why there may be fewer books in Her Majesty's prisons. BBC Two's Revers reviews. And we add two iridescent tracks to the pretend iPod.
Hello, everybody. Welcome once again to the Parish Council. The podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw. He's fast as lightning. In fact, he's a little bit frightening. He's Terence Dacum.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello there. I was actually going to do that introduction there in a very high-pitched voice.
Oh, right.
And make a gag about thinking I was the Turkish Prime Minister, but I've got such a terrible chesty cough that I couldn't pull it off. But have you heard that clip?
I've heard the Turkish Prime Minister. Yes, it's like he's ingested helium.
Yes, well, our Rona Martin, who you'll hear later, said to me that he sounded like one of the mice off the mice organ in Bagpuss, which is the best comparison I've heard, yes.
It's the most unusual vocal style.
It is. Not one that's ideal for a politician trying to make a profound point when he's public speaking.
and the more excited he gets, the higher the pitch.
That's exactly what happens, But, I mean, it's not his normal voice, is it?
Isn't it?
No, he appears to be become afflicted in a similar way to me, but my voice seems to have gone down, and he's just gone...
I thought that was his normal demeanour.
No, I think he's given rather one too many impassioned addresses, and it's sort of wrecked his voice a bit, yeah.
Those of us listening... through headphones, you know, we're worried about your cough.
Yeah.
We're thinking, why then would we hear the sound of someone inhaling a cigarette?
No, you're mistaken, I'm sure. I'm sucking a tune.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, I'll tell you what, Magnus, you're... No, here's a thing to tell you. No, really. You've mentioned before that you don't go to a hairdresser's. And that you attend one of these low-brow places I've heard about. It's a barber's shop, I believe they're called.
Yes, absolutely. A very, very nice one in Sheffield, I go to now.
Yeah. Award-winning, apparently.
Yes.
Well, with your left-wing views, you can now follow the example of your comrades under your great leader, because Kim Jong-un is reported to have decreed that all college students in Korea should adopt his hairstyle, which would, well, I was thinking, it would certainly make you stand out in the crowd in rural Derbyshire. Now, I'm willing to donate the funds for you to have this Kim Jong-un hairstyle, Magnus Shaw. Will you take up this offer and ask for a Kim cut?
Well, I don't know if you need. I sort of already have one vaguely similar.
It is similar, isn't it?
I think it behoves a gentleman to have that close crop at the sides and back. I think I know you go for one of these home counties floppy affairs, but
that's it. Yeah, that's
it. But I rather favour the George Orwell, you know, close crop at the sides and back there. I think it looks fine. I mean, I know you, Kim Jong-un is, you know, mad as a pan of sparrows, isn't he? But he does have a smart haircut. You've got to give it to the fella.
I suppose, yes, it's depends on your viewpoint. But defectors from North Korea say that there actually is a form of fashion police in the country. They check for appropriate dress, and they look for the mandatory lapel pins with the images of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's predecessors. Now, I don't know what they'd make of British hen parties where girls wear "I'm with the bride" badges, or you, Magnus Shaw, because I imagine you probably wear CND or coal not dull badges.
Well, I certainly have worn both those badges. Not recently, I'm afraid.
Well, you'd probably be safe in North Korea. Except, well, let's see. It says their edicts say that these fashion police that roam the streets, you can be imprisoned for wearing denim jeans, wearing clothes with English wording, or women, they can be thrown into prison for having dresses that are above the knee.
Yes.
Yeah,
I think there's only 12 state-approved haircuts for women as well.
Apparently so. Yes. Yeah. So you know you have to. Someone has to inspect you when you have the latest North Korean government edict on hair. Actually, says that anyone not going for the Kim Jong Un style is an unhygienic anti-socialist fool and a blind follower of the bourgeois lifestyle.
Yeah, quite right. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
Old men, by the way, Magnus. Old men are allowed a comb over to hide balding.
Oh, the whole thing's fallen over there. I don't think that's appropriate. So.
You're allowed to have a 7-centimeter long comb over if you're a balding man.
I think if there is one haircut that should be prescribed by the state, it should be the comb over, really.
Yeah, I suppose so. Kim Jong-un, he says, long hair on men hampers brain activity by taking oxygen away from the brain, which kind of explains the rise of James May, doesn't it?
Yes, certainly.
Yeah, there's something to it.
Explanation there, yeah, indeed, yeah. And he talked about wearing words or images from the West. I do recall that some poor soul was once mobbed and roughed up in the street in Tibet. One of these backpacker types. He was wearing a Sergeant Bilko T-shirt,
right?
Which the locals took to be an image of the Dalai Lama in military clothing.
Oh dear! Yeah. So they took great offence to
did,
that.
Yeah.
Just shows the dangers of these elements of fashion. So maybe North Korea have got it right. Just keep it simple, and you can't offend anyone.
No, but I will. I shall go and have a Kim Jong-un.
Oh, lovely!
And report back.
Okay. Well, we'll need photographic evidence, of course.
Yeah, because I don't mind. I don't think it's a bad old haircut.
Good grief! Lovely.
It's the intellectual rigors that take place beneath it that's a little problematic.
Yeah. See, when you said that you think it's a lovely haircut, I was just giving a sideways glance to all the listeners there, you know, kind of knowing look, and going, yes, indeed, Magnus Shaw. I tell you what, Magnus Shaw, let's just say for a minute I was a normal person.
Yeah, okay? Well, the chance would be a fine thing.
Yes, and say as a normal person, I have a smartphone. I'm sure after listening to this podcast, I'd be saying to myself, you know, I wish there was an app that would allow me to listen to any of the Rocking Vicar podcasts at any time. Mm. Well, Magnus Shaw, I think you can make such dreams come true.
I can do my best, yeah. Yeah, we now have this podcast available via an iPhone app. It has to be an Apple iPhone at the moment, I'm afraid.
Okay.
So this is only good for your iPhone people.
Well, any sensible person would have an iPhone, so, you know, our discriminating listeners, that's fine.
Yes, that's right, yes. All you have to do is to navigate to a URL. I hate it when URLs are read out, because I think everybody instantly forgets them, but I will repost the URL on Twitter a few times. It's on the website anyway, actually. If you go to the Rocking Vehicle website, the URL is there. All you have to do is to take your iPhone browser, anyone will do, to that particular URL, click on it, and there'll be a little hovering device inviting you to click on it. It says the add to iPhone or words to that effect, and bingo, all the podcasts will be behind a little app that appears on your home screen of your iPhone.
You can listen to the entire archive, which is a little bit worrying. I wouldn't want to listen to the first few again.
But you can, because...
Yeah, but you can.
Yes.
Well, that's marvellous.
The wonderful marvels of modern technology, you can do that now.
It's
yeah.
a fantastic thing. I wonder if they can listen in North Korea. Or Turkey. Or Turkey, indeed. Yeah,
they're keen on switching off.
They are
on social
yes.
media, but
yes.
certainly in any self-respecting liberal democracy, the app is there for you.
Ichir Magnashaw, the winner of the UK version of X Factor, seems to have a shorter and shorter shelf life of fame. In general, my interest tends to wane the moment the contest is over. Once they return to civilian life, the singers somehow lose the glamour and suddenly seem smaller than life. Well, I never did see or hear the appeal of the 2012 winner, James Arthur. His wailing awkwardness never did it for me. Well, ever since winning the competition, Arthur has gone out of his way to mess up his career trajectory. The latest example is his sacking of his PR company this week, publicly on Twitter. This leads me to the big question. It's my big question of the week, Magnashaw. What the hell is wrong with James Arthur?
Well, you mean apart from everything?
Yes, apart from everything.
I don't know. I just think these people are ill-prepared for what happens to them once they've won the contest. Yeah, with some noticeable exceptions, but ill-prepared for what happens to them. And then ill-advised, you know, thereafter. I think James Arthur, he's probably quite a surly and a difficult character. And he's forgotten that being the case, it's a good idea to sit on that. So if you're trying to project yourself to the pop youth, you know, perhaps Lou Reed got away with it and Van Morrison got away with it, but you ain't either of those, chummy. And it might have been better not to get into these, you know, appalling spats on Twitter, or indeed to slag off the people who are working hard to maintain your pop career. I'm all for a controversialist, but I think a true controversialist has to, carry out their war against the world with a bit of style and panache. And every time this fella sticks his head above the parapet, he just confirms everybody's notion that he's a right royal pain.
Perhaps his meltdowns that he has, and Cher Lloyd is another example perhaps they happen because, I think you kind of just mentioned it in passing, Nick, these singers, they don't work their way up the ladder in the traditional sense. They haven't played gigs in front of three people playing dominoes, or they've never dealt with hecklers, never travelled to gigs in the back of a sort of Bockety van. They've only known since rolling up to X Factor, I suppose, the opposite of that, people carriers, limousines, people wanting to take photos, hotel room service. They've got no concept of how to deal with fame because it's sprung on them overnight like a lottery winner.
Yes, I think that's got a lot to do with it. I don't think those lessons have been learned, and so they're making all their mistakes in public. But it's not compulsory. We didn't see Leona Lewis or Alexander Burke make these enormous clunkers and fail to endear themselves to any reasonable human being. So it doesn't have to be like that, but you know, he's decided it is going to be like that. And at least when Liam Gallagher projected his prickly personality onto the world, he was already a big rock star. He had that luxury, I suppose. But James Arthur is, I would say, clinging on to a pop career by his fingernails, and by opening his mouth, you know, a finger pops off each time. So I think he will live to rue the day, perhaps.
Yeah, it's only 6 months ago that James Arthur was on the back foot, saying he was extremely disappointed with himself after he posted a rap with homophobic lyrics to SoundCloud, and he had to hand over his Twitter account to his management last year after a string of awkward incidents. But I think some of the issues this week have been caused by him grasping his Twitter account back. But no, I don't think his career will have any longevity at all, and I suspect very soon that we'll be saying, you know, James who.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I think all things are forgivable if you're, you know, technically brilliant. There's a lot of performers out there who are troublesome and tricky. One thinks of Paul Simon, but you'll forgive Paul Simon just about anything by dint of his astonishing talent. You know, James Arthur is not Paul Simon.
No, we say pa or meh, perhaps meh,
or even ta-da.
Yeah, to James Arthur. Well, Magnus Shaw, when life becomes too confusing for me, I generally turn to Rona Martin for help and guidance. And so it is this week, as we learned of the breakup of a marriage of two people who, in this day and age, we are expected to label as personalities. Rona, Gwyneth Paltrow has described her separation from Chris Martin off of that Coldplay as a conscious uncoupling. So help me, Rona. Help me, Rona. What did Gwyneth mean by conscious uncoupling?
Well, Terence, apparently it comes from an essay entitled Unconscious Uncoupling, written by Paltrow's spiritual advisors, Dr. Habib Sadeghi and Dr. Sherry Sammy. And to quote, it said, although it looks like everything is coming apart, it's actually all coming back together, they conclude. The Oxford English Dictionary has a citation of the use of uncoupling to describe the end of relationships from as far back as 1942. You know, call me spacey if you like, Terence. You know, feel free. But
I possibly will.
Yeah, you probably will. But I kind of get what she means. It's a bit of Californian hyperbole, albeit. But basically, it just seems like they're as a couple, they're making a conscious process of emotional unbonding in some ways in order to create stronger familial bonds, maybe to ensure that while they're not mummy and daddy married and living under one roof, they're still maintaining a secure and happy environment for the children. And they've, well, certainly it's Gwyneth's words, not her husband's, but she's purposely chosen some very non-aggressive sort of verbs, because as we know, Terence, harsh words equal harsh emotion, hard emotions and energies. And it's all about maintaining equilibrium. And I'm sure maybe some of us have, in a way, taken steps to overcome relationships from our past. And maybe I certainly have, possibly consciously taken steps on my own after the time to let go and not have the residue of that relationship affecting my present and possibly hopefully future. So, you know, I think it's just new age speak for something that, you know, is probably a very healthy thing to do. And, you know, it's great that, you know, they're being responsible enough to not have a massive big public catfight. They've probably hopefully gotten past that stage of detesting the sight. Hopefully.
Yeah.
So, you know, it sounds a bit nonsensical.
But, you know, why do famous people feel they've got to do this? It's none of our business. Why are they going to put statements out?
Yeah, I don't really know, because I personally don't give a hoot about them. I'm not celebrity, celeb conscious, to be honest. Their relationship status doesn't put me up nor down. They're just another couple, and it's always sad when, you know, a couple stop being a couple. That's a shame, and if there's children involved. But yeah, is it any of our business? Well, not really. I don't think it's in anybody's interest, but Gwyneth is foisted this information upon us. They could have quietly done their parting of their ways, and you know, none of us would have been any worse for not knowing. But I suppose it's all about keeping them in the public awareness. Their careers are it's necessary for the continuation of their careers for the public to have their names in mind. And I suppose to have it in a more positive frame of mind is no bad thing. But really, it's nobody's business.
Nobody's
and it's a bit
business,
arrogant,
no.
I suppose, I think, ultimately, for them to assume that, you know, we need to know all about their lives.
Perhaps it's a concern that if they hadn't taken control of the situation and put out the conscious uncoupling statement that the tabloids and those gossipy magazines would have portrayed it in a different way rather than this rather grown-up way, which I think you're right when you say that for their children and everything, it's probably a very good way of doing it, because it takes away all that sort of anger and warring parties. But I just thought I'd tell you a quick anecdote, a quick story, because, you know, we're kind of, I think, agreeing that if they are going to put out statements, then this was a good way of, you know, good use of language and a good way of doing it, despite it being a bit new agey. But just in contrast, I can never forget a friend of mine, Kate, she just spent a weekend away with her husband. They've been married about 5 years, and he bought her flowers on this weekend away. It was kind of like a romantic thing. And they came back home. She went off to work on the Monday morning. And when she got home that evening, he'd packed all his things and gone, and he'd left her a note because he wanted to be with somebody else.
Oh.
I know. Awful. And that's really not the ideal way to do
immature
it.
Immature and cruel.
Isn't it? Very. I can never forget about
that. No,
as the contrast to Gwyneth.
Yeah,
and
that's how Chris. Not to do it. That's really horrible. Really horrible. So, I would say, you know, flip side is that Gwyneth and Chris are, you know, being quite mature.
So do you think, you know, there is a good way to break up? Do you think that this is probably the example?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there is a good way to break up. It's not always possible, obviously. But they appear to be on the same page. But I'll go back and say that we've heard nothing from Chris Martin. I would know the sound of Chris Martin's voice if he chapped at my front door right now, but sure, he's a pretty sound chap. His heart's probably in the right place. I think they're both probably okay. They've both had quite a privileged upbringing. They both have. Maybe, you know, the way they're going about things is indicative of a somewhat detached and privileged lifestyle that they've both led. Maybe they assume that they're example setters to the rest of us, or maybe not. But there are, of course, the right way to break up would be amicably, respectfully, and with the ability to hold in your heart what once was good and romantic and loving, which has evolved into something different rather than hating or, you know, something negative. But it's not always possible. So, you know, they're very lucky that if they are still on a very similar page.
Well, Ro, only temporarily, I'm going to consciously uncouple from you now.
Righto, I will do the same.
Thanks, Ro. We'll speak to you soon.
And if you were to ask me, after all that we've been through, to believe in magic, well, yes, I do.
Yes, he does, poor Chris Martin, Rona Martin there, talking to me about Gwyneth and Chris.
No relation.
No relation, no. Social media in the UK, Magnus Shaw, was aflame earlier this week when, if you read only Twitter and didn't dig deeper, you would be left with the impression that the Secretary of State for Justice, Chris Grayling, a worrying 7 years younger than me, had banned all prisoners from reading books. Indeed, looking at some tweets from otherwise sensible people, you'd be forgiven for believing that Grayling was actually visiting prisons in person, putting every book in a huge pile, pouring on gasoline and throwing a lit match at the lot. Magnus Shaw, are you going to tell us, as many tweeters did, that this is another example of hateful behaviour by a hated government?
No, not quite, because I, you know, unlike some, did take the time and trouble to find out exactly what was going on. And books aren't being banned in prison. As I understand it, the ability to send somebody a book through the post for them to receive in prison is being restricted, if not outlawed. But that said, I do think Chris Grayling or his people have some kind of ability to manage the media, and the media are inclined to swoop on things that are dangled in front of them. So I would have thought this was put together in an attempt to demonstrate Chris Grayling's department's tough stance on prisons and prisoners, and it's somewhat backfired on them. So I don't I wouldn't rush to Chris Grayling's defence and say he's sorely misunderstood innocent party here, because I think he was trying to make play out of a new policy, and it rather backfired on him.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, because I understand this policy has been in place since November of last year, and it was only just that the liberal end of the media, of the Britain press in particular, sort of noticed this earlier in the week. There's been no controversy in prisons whatsoever about this. Nobody seems to have protested at all, because as you sort of mentioned, the reality is that any prisoner may have up to 12 books in his cell at any one time, and it's got free access to the prison library, and the only restriction is, as you mentioned, that books can't be sent in as parcels from outside, because they have been and may be used to smuggle contraband such as drugs. So it seems an eminently sensible move to me.
And pound notes, according to one spokesman.
And pound notes, yes, I know. Sweet, wasn't it? Yeah. They might smuggle in pound notes.
Yes, no, I understand it's been got up by the ranting and the angry, but even if it's a policy from last November, it doesn't mean it wasn't pushed into the spotlight by certain sources, and didn't quite play as they expected it to. But then perhaps it did. You know, we're only looking at the sort of liberal intelligentsia's reaction to it. But I yes, you're right. The books haven't been banned in prison, and it's foolish to say they have.
Let me put my soapbox on top of my high horse for a moment. I mean, because sadly, in many cases, the number of books a prisoner is allowed is irrelevant. Civitas, the think tank, it describes itself as classical liberal. So far from being a sort of right wing thing. They say 52% of male offenders, 71% of female offenders have no qualifications whatsoever. And most pertinently to this subject, 48%, that's almost half, of prisoners have literacy skills below level one. And that's the expected level of an 11-year-old. So reading skills below that of an 11-year-old. 49% of all prisoners have been excluded from school at some point. So one might say, oh, well, let's put literacy courses on in prisons? And of course they do. But here's my last stat, but it's a last statistic. But 1/3 of all prison courses are not completed, and at least half of those are because the release of the transfer or the transfer of the prisoner to another establishment. And this wastes £30 million annually. So, I think instead of getting heated up about prisoners not being allowed to smuggle in crack in copies of The Road Less Travelled, we should be banging the heads of all the sort of appropriate agencies together to improve literacy and education in prisons.
Yeah, no argument there. I mean, actually, I'm quite reassured that 2/3 of literacy courses in prison are completed. That's good. That's pretty good news. I think, you know, if you looked at an FE college on the outside as to how many students complete their courses, you know, probably comparable, I would have thought. So that's good news. But yes, to cut a course short that a prisoner is undertaking because you've got to transfer them is lunacy and like you say, a waste of money. So I don't disagree with that at all.
And one other aspect, my final sort of soapbox.
Hold on, you said the last one was the final one.
No, that was my final stat. That was my final statistic. Oh, so I've still got another a point that's burning inside me. I've just got to tell you my final point. When people are regularly in jail, they never have one problem. You know, they may have intertwined, let's see, drug, alcohol, behavioral, mental, employment, housing issues that need to be addressed in cohesion. But all of the agencies that deal with those issues that I mentioned, they all work in silos, in sort of bunkers, really, apart from each other. So the cycle just goes round and round. You go to prison, you get released, you have problems, you undertake criminal behaviour, you go back to prison. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's part of the overall picture, because we don't resolve these problems. We just keep endorsing them, really.
Yeah, I think that's manifest for all to see. I think that's exactly what happens. There's a shop at the end of the street in Nottingham, which is also home to the prison, and this shop does extremely well for itself. I know this for a fact. A friend of mine works in the voluntary services and has spoken to prisoners and to the proprietor of the shop. And do you know why? Well, the reason is that you get, I think, £46 in cash when you are released from prison to begin to rehabilitate yourself. And of course, every penny of that is spent on cigarettes, alcohol and such like in the shop at the end of the street.
Yes, yes. My own knowledge would echo that, yeah. I think we'd be on safe ground if we suggested that the Reverend Adam Smallbone, it would take a liberal view on the free distribution of books in prisons. On Monday, Rev returned to BBC Two for a third season, with Tom Hollander playing the title role and with a strong cast, including Olivia Colman, Miles Jupp, Joanna Scanlon, Vicky Pepperdine. In this episode, Olivia Colman gives birth in a taxi, and Adam links up with the local imam to raise money for a playground. Rev was pretty new to me, Magnus Shaw, but you're quite a fan.
I got into it in season 2, which I think was the last season, and then went back and started with season 1. I think it's terrific, and I think the reason it's terrific is because of Tom Hollander, who sort of conceived it and writes it, and of course plays Adam Smallbone in it. Mm. I think in large part the credit goes to him, although he's picked a really good supporting cast as well. But I like it because it's gentle and sharp at the same time. It's not shouty or hectoring, but the points it makes are quite deep and profound, but are made in a very charming way. And with the exception maybe of, I don't know, perhaps Father Ted, which was much more surreal, I can't think of a comedy that is both lighthearted and profound at the same time. And in the same way that this is. And I think it does it so well. And Tom Hollander's so watchable and has created a very, very believable character. It's genuinely funny, not belly laughs, but it raises wry smiles throughout the whole half hour.
It has a light touch, as you say. There's no real sort of big gags in it. It's more the sort of ambience. I worry a little bit about Olivia Colman in the sense that, you know, she's a great actress, of course, you know, and we've all seen her in many things. And that's the problem. She's becoming the Claire Balding of, you know, sort of light entertainment and drama, really. Is that these days, no casting director will get a shot underway unless they've got Olivia Colman in the
No, I think it's unfortunate for some actors, but particularly actors who are, you know, in demand or busy, because you obviously have no control as to when anything's broadcast. So you could see Olivia Colman in a drama tonight and then in a comedy the following night. And, you know, it's all too easy to think, oh, you know, she's spreading herself a bit thin. But, of course, the thing you saw tonight could have been shot a year and a half ago. So there's no way of preventing overexposure. It's a bit unfortunate.
A very sound point indeed. I love the line from the imam who talking to Tom Hollander as Reverend Adam Smallbone, who said, I love your churches. There's always so much space.
Kyver Novak was really good in this, actually. He had a real presence, and his ability to switch off his charm in a split second was really clever, really very, very good indeed. And the following day, I heard a few people talking on the radio about the plot points of this episode. And they confirmed, particularly in inner city London, this is exactly what's happening, is that the mosques are full to bursting and the C of E churches are very
empty,
very thin on the ground, you know, in terms of congregation. And there's a certain envy from the traditional church to the Islamic community that they actually turn up and the Church of England doesn't seem to be able to achieve that. And, you know, that being the pivot for this episode was, right on the money, I thought. But I did like the fact that that they both had empathy for each other, and that the imam was very generous to the last in crediting. Yes. Even though Tom Hollander had managed to electrocute him, he still shared the credit.
Just because you electrocuted me doesn't mean we can't be friends.
Yes, exactly. I thought that was great. And I did think it was nice to see a Muslim portrayed as somebody moderate and generous, because there is, in some shows, a lazy fallback position that the Muslim has to be in some way oppressive or repressive, and it wasn't the case here, and that he was sort of, he had his hand on the tiller where Tom Hollander was floundering badly in his attempts to be a local religious figure. I thought he made some really, really nice points without bashing you over the head with them. And it was genuinely funny, which is the important thing. And, long may it last. It's great.
And of much interest to indie pop fans, because the alcoholic Colin is played by the ex-bass player in The Fall, Steve Evans. He managed to last 2 years in The Fall.
That's
which
good,
was,
yes.
That's something of a record.
I guess you could chuck a pebble in any high street in England and hit an ex-Fall bass player, couldn't you?
Absolutely, yeah.
So. Yeah, that's great. And I will see, if you're new to it, this is a character you'll see a lot more of, that the fellow who knocks on the door and offers to babysit.
Oh, good God, yes, he was frightening.
Well, in previous seasons, he used to always knock on the door and say, DVD. He'd always got a carry bag full of pirate DVDs. He's moved on to babysitting now. But if you didn't recognise him, he's the fellow who plays the very fiercely ambitious and talented surgeon in Holby City. He's the polar opposite character in both those shows, and you barely recognisable, but when it's pointed out to you, you can't miss him.
Well, this was Monday, BBC Two at 10 o'clock p.m., Rev, Season 3, and Monday's was Episode 1 of 6. It was written by James Wood and directed by Peter Cattaneo for Big Talk Productions for the BBC.
And, 6 isn't nearly enough. We
Well, yes.
No, not nearly enough. It should have been a 12 series. So a 12-episode run.
Yeah. Each of the three seasons had six episodes one special. Yes, yeah. Now, Magnus Short, Chris Grayling, Gwyneth Paltrow, James Arthur, and Kim Jong-un.
Oh, yes.
They've all been in touch. In the last few minutes, to say that's enough about Olivia Colman. What we really want to know, they're saying, we know this time it's Magnus Shaw is going first on the pretend iPod. Yeah. And so we really want you to move on, and we want to hear what Magnus Shaw has for the pretend iPod. A closing feature in which we tell you about a piece of music we like, we play a little snippet of it at the end of the podcast, and it joins this mega playlist on the Rocking Vicar website in the form of a pretend iPod. And it's also on Spotify, Magnus Shaw, under your name.
My name.
Magnus Shaw.
That's right, yes. Well, you're right, I am going first this week, because we alternate in the interests of fairness and balance, and I go up front this week. You might have noticed that certain acts can only really come from certain countries. A Dutch Bruce Springsteen would be a very different prospect, wouldn't he, really?
Wouldn't work.
It wouldn't work, exactly. Likewise, nobody would make the mistake of thinking that Bob Marley was from Spain. He's not Spanish, is he? He's very definitely Jamaican.
That, too, would not
work. It would not work. And, of course, only Scotland could generate the Proclaimers. Indeed, it could be argued that the most Scottish act since, well, since Andy Stewart, and unlike Andy, they're very hard to dislike. Now, fathom this if you can. The first material from Charlie and Craig Reed, who are the Proclaimers, Throw the R Away, their debut single, arrived with us in 1987. That's 27 years ago. 27
wow.
years ago. And I mentioned last week that Tanita Tikaram must have access to some sort of elixir of youth. Well, she's clearly been sharing it with the Reed twins. I met Charlie and Craig briefly last year in the summer sunshine of Oxfordshire, and they barely look any different from the intense young men I first glimpsed. Now, I had to wrap my brains. When did I first see the Proclaimers? I think it was on ITV's The Roxy, which was their short-lived equivalent of Top of the Pops. And that was over a quarter of a century ago. And they look more or less the same. Nary grey hair, trim fellows, and of course, totally recognisable as those same guys. I think it must be all that Iron Brew, really, that's doing it. Of course.
You're really alienating everybody.
Yes,
north of the
exactly. Rona Martin will be breathing down my neck, to say the very least. Of course, by the pop rule book, the Proclaimers should never have graduated from the bars of Uchtomukti.
I love saying that word. I love it. I was hoping you'd say Uchtomukti.
Yeah, we need to be taught to say it properly by Rona, I think. But they should really never have graduated from the bars of Uchtomukti, where they started to ply their trade. In their thick glasses and sensible shirts and intense expressions and thickly accented singing voices, they really failed to tick almost every box on the rock star application form. But perhaps that's what makes them so appealing. That and, of course, their tremendous songs. They're tender when they need to be, raucous enough to find a place on the closing titles of a Pixar animation. They just have that knack of rolling out joyously memorable and uplifting tunes by the truckload. Now, I've chosen Sunshine on Leith, which is the title track of their first album. It's a celebration of the Dockland area of Edinburgh, where they were born in 1962. Very few songs, I think, are this heartfelt, swooping and stirring. Every note mines their twin Celtic souls for every nugget of passion and pride. Listen to Sunshine on Leith, and suddenly we're all Scottish now. Mm-hmm. Also, I think the Proclaimers are the only band who could refer to God as the Chief, without fear of ridicule. So may the Chief bless Charlie and Craig, and may the sunshine on Leith forever, because my pick this week is the Proclaimers and Sunshine on Leith.
Do you know, Magnus Shaw, I am so stupid. I know this doesn't come as, you know, a major surprise, but I am so stupid because only yesterday, when I knew you'd pick this and I was looking up the lads, I thought their names were Craig and Charlie Proclaimer.
Did you?
I really, really did. Of course, now I can see how stupid that would be. Because, you know, the Proclaimers, I can see why they call themselves Proclaimers.
That would be it.
I
that
didn't
would be
realize...
handy, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You know that Noel and Liam aren't called Noel and Liam Oasis, don't you?
Oh, God, yeah, I know. Honestly, I feel so stupid. I really thought that, you know, that on their birth certificates, you know, it said Craig Proclaimer and Charlie Proclaimer.
Mr. Proclaimers.
That's not
even a surname, is it?
Oh, I feel such a fool.
They are brothers with the surname Reed, just like the two fellas off your Jesus and Mary.
Jesus and Mary chain. Yes. I love this track. It's just a gorgeous track. And if one was only really aware of the big hit single, you know, When Ye Go, Will Ye Bring Back?
Well, 500 Miles was the really big one.
And that's the stomping isn't it? I will be 500 miles. Then Sunshine on Leaf would come as a lovely surprise because it's so gentle and beautiful. It's such a contrast. It's lovely. But how many years did you say? 27 years
since the first thing. I've seen them many times, and they're absolutely, you know, sterling value live. There's no dry ice or enormous laser light show. It really is just Charlie and Craig, two mics and a guitar and a backing band. But you know, when you've got that kind of songwriting talent, that is all you need, and they're a joy to behold in a live setting as well.
And good luck to them. And I think I don't know if you'll agree with me, but you see, what's so gorgeous about having acts like Craig and Charlie Proclaimer still around is that if they emerge today with, you know, your X Factor kind of mentality, they wouldn't get an audition.
No, that's exactly right. And that's sort of the point I was making, is that they don't tick any of the right boxes at all. And yet, of course, it doesn't matter a jot because they're really, really talented and very charming and unassuming into the bargain. We're the worst for that attitude, really.
Yeah, I'm going back even further than your 27 years.
I'm just choking to death after my monologue there.
I was going to ignore it, but I couldn't. You're still alive.
Yeah,
that's the main
about,
thing.
We were all unsure
after that little.
I'm sure there's plenty of people listening in a similar state. It's that time of year, isn't it?
It was a cough that carried him off. It was a coffin they carried him off in. I've often spoken and written that, in my view, punk rock never actually existed. Certainly not in the reported way of some great movement rising up from the youth, scaring the nation with their safety pins and ambition. Even the passing notion that such a scheme was the brainchild of a clothes shop owner from the wrong end of the King's Road is just laughable, really. The New York Dolls, they were never the forerunners of punk, and when they appeared on the Old Grey Whistle Test, everyone except Malcolm McLaren considered them nothing more than Stone's copyists. Whispering Bob, in my opinion, was right on the button with his mock rock comment. To me, the Sex Pistols were like a cartoon, a comic book group, like the Monkees or the Archies. Then suddenly, in this period, groups that the week before had long hair and were playing covers from Sweetheart of the Rodeo in the Brecknock and the Greyhound were wearing leather jackets and shouting for anarchy. But if any band could lay claim to be the fathers of punk, if it existed, then it would fall to the feet of four blokes from Forest Hill, Queens, New York, who got together in 1974 and changed each of their surnames to Ramone. As later copied by the Pistols in particular, there was, again, a cartoon strip element to the Ramones, their adopted characteristics, the black leather jackets, the ripped jeans, the short, short songs played at breakneck speed, and with lyrics that had not really been influenced by Milton, Keats or Shakespeare. But they were something new. I checked my diary this week for 1977, And I found Sunday, the 5th of June, 1977, the Roundhouse in Chalk Farm Road, London. We went to see the Ramones, supported by Talking Heads. And the Saints as well. When I remember the Ramones, on came the Ramones. Every song started the same way: 1, 2, 3, 4, and boom, off they went for 2 minutes, and then the song ended. And as soon as the song ended, 1, 2, 3, 4, bang, off again. And I think they did their whole set, probably was 15, 16 songs in about 28 minutes. And the Roundhouse was like a sauna in a heat wave. I could, of course, have chosen any from a number of Ramones tracks to exemplify their sort of cartoonish joy. I picked a track that was released as one of three singles from the 1978 album, Road to Ruin. It was their first album to last over 30 minutes. The 12 tracks clocking in at a massive 31 minutes and 2 seconds. 12 tracks, 31 minutes. Recorded in June 1978 at Media Sound, New York, released in September 1978, not troubling the Billboard Hot 100 at all, but reaching number 39 in the UK Top 40. 2 minutes, 44 seconds, Ramones, Don't Come Close.
Oh, yeah, well, you're absolutely right. There's so many Ramones songs, and therefore so many that you could pick. But Don't Come Close is as good as... option as any. There's a really, really good Ramones track. And I think the interesting about Ramones is the Ramones is that they influenced so many bands. And like you say, could arguably be the grandfathers of punk rock. But I don't think they set out to be any of those things. I think they just did what they wanted to do. And I think they just followed their instincts, and they just wanted to play pared down rock and roll, and just did it so well that everybody was astonished. But I think nobody was more surprised than the band themselves.
And sadly, to end on a sad note, three of them no longer with us now. Right. And you know, they're only young, and only Tommy Ramone, the drummer, remains. So it's a short spell in life as well as in the limelight. But as you say, incredibly influential. And if you look back to their very earliest recordings, and or even to the live album which they recorded in London, I think in 77, I think, you'll see what I mean if you're too young to remember them, because it was just 1, 2, 3, 4 into a song, out of a song, 1, 2, 3, 4 into the next song. It was fantastic.
Is that the It's Alive album?
Yes, a great album, isn't it?
It's just a fantastic album. It really is one of the best, if not the best, live album I know of. When I first heard that, it bowled me over every bit as much as the first Clash album or Never Mind the Bollocks. I just thought, this is it. It really is.
It's just great.
It's dripping with adrenaline there. And it's so spare, you know. They're in such a hurry. One thing you can say about the Ramones is they were in a hurry.
They really did. I'm not exaggerating when they would say they would do 15, 16, 17 songs in 25, 30 minutes, because it's a boom out there. And just to reiterate what Magnus said there, if you're not too familiar with the Ramones, look for that first live album. It's called It's Alive. And the reason I say that is that in the spirit of milking every penny out of them, the record companies have actually released 7 live Ramones albums.
Well, that's the only one you need. Yeah. It's Alive. It's a double set, although I don't suppose that matters when you're streaming it or anything these days, but it is a double set, and it's stupendous, absolutely fantastic album. And then listen to it very, very loud.
And also talking about milking, 14 best of compilations have been released. Absolutely ridiculous. But the Ramones, It's a live album. And again, I think two absolutely wonderful tracks this week: The Proclaimers, Sunshine on Leith, and The Ramones, Don't Come Close.
Two jewels gleaming in the firmament of the pretend iPod. And with those...
Well, you made it through. You got through it.
I just about got through it, yes. We're not quite there yet. But just to let you know, we're scuttling off to the Balinese Marble Championships at Somerset House in just 10 minutes' time. So we must get going and take a moment to thank Mr. Terence D.
Be seeing you.
And, of course, Rona Martin for her earlier contribution. And we'll see you, our favourite listener, next week for more of the good stuff. Bye-bye.
Production.
I could give you nobody's friend. A good friend, nobody's friend.